Richard said 20 minutes ago it was time to start, but I'm glad that you're all here and we can open our Bibles and study about the history and the geography of the Bible. We're on Lesson 41 in our study this morning, Lesson 41, which is a review, actually, of Lessons number 37 through 40, which is quite a comprehensive period dealing with the intertestamental period. What we have referred to as the years of biblical silence. The writer of our book refers to this period as the years of biblical silence. How long was this period? 400 years. Yes, 400 years. A lot of things can happen in 400 years, as we have already studied. When we study concerning the scheme of redemption, I want us to be impressed with the greatness of God, to worship and praise Him, the consideration that He had for us before time began. In this intertestamental period, we're reading about a period that the Bible doesn't discuss in detail specifically, but it is mentioned through the prophecy of Daniel, as we have already discussed a number of times from Daniel chapter 2. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But this portion of our study, we're looking at the review questions on page 165. But as we begin our study this morning, we're kind of in the middle of these questions. The short answers down at the bottom of page 165. Short answers. And we'll get through these and then we'll talk about the Herodian family. Number one in our list, what was the official language of the Grecian Empire? Now that's a freebie. Alright, Greek. Very good. I tell you, thought hard on that. Number two, what was the daily language in the homes of Palestine? Aramaic.
Depends on what time you're talking about.
Well, yes. During this time it was Aramaic, toward the end of the intertestamental period. And then number three, what was the language when the Old Testament scriptures were written? Now this gets back, Randy, to what you were talking about. What was that?
Hebrew.
That's right. Now why is that significant? Why are those questions even in our lesson book? What languages were being spoken when? What have we progressed to?
Well, it's significant because the New Testament was written in Greek.
All right, it's significant because of that. Of course, the Old Testament written in Hebrew, and then we find that toward the end of the Old Testament period, Aramaic became pretty much a commonly spoken language. But when we come to the New Testament, we're reading of the period of time in which the Roman Empire exists, and Alexander the Great, the empire just previous to that, he desired to make everything Grecian. Greek culture, Greek language, Greek gods, and so forth and so on. And so that attributes the Greek language to this period, which helps us as well when we began to think about the revelation of God. Now we've got a question on that, but I almost ask it. We'll ask these in order. Why was there hatred between the Jews and the Samaritans? David? Okay. All right, yes. When we are first introduced to the people that developed into the Samaritan people, how did that come about? Now, this is a question sometimes we don't think too much about.
Plus, the Samaritans controlled a larger section of the land than the Jews did at that point. And so that also caused more animosity.
All right, very good, very good. We've got a, we have in our mentality, I suppose, that when the captivity occurred, nobody lived there. And that's just not true. The Assyrian king, you talked about the bringing in of the other captives. This is what developed into the Samaritan people. And there's a passage that, strangely enough, we sometimes don't cast away up here in our memory banks somehow. In 2 Kings chapter 17, I want you to remember that passage. Melissa has mentioned some of the content of that passage, how that these people were brought into the land, and they were being eaten of the lions that were in the land. And their complaint was, we don't know the God of this land. And so they brought back one of the priests and so forth, as you heard Melissa express. But the context of that is 2 Kings chapter 17, when the Assyrians conquered the northern 10 tribes, and it was their practice to mix up the people. And that was the origination of the Samaritan people. Now, when you look back into the book of Ezra, we're talking about the period of rebuilding. And in Ezra chapter 4, as Melissa very well expressed, we have the Samaritans desiring to help rebuild the temple. And the Israelites wouldn't have anything to do with it. And then, of course, in Nehemiah chapter 13, we've got these people intermarrying. And God had forbidden that. And some, obviously, were marrying those who were of Samaritan origin. We talk about Sanballat. Who was Sanballat? You might do a little search on him and find that he was a Samaritan. And so these are the enemies of God's people during the time of restoration. Who was the prophet who predicted a famine of the hearing of the Word of God? Who was that? Amos. Very good. Chapter 8, verse 11. Amos chapter 8 verse 11. In the context of Amos, he had already said that there was a famine in the land, or there was going to be, when they would have cleanness of teeth and they would go from one city to the other, you recall from Amos chapter 4. But in Amos chapter 8, he declares, there's going to be a famine, not of food, but of the Word of God. What brought about the Maccabean revolt? Now that jumps us forward from Amos considerably. What brought about the Maccabean revolt? First of all, who do I want to pick on? Chris, tell me what the Maccabean revolt was.
Well, that was their rejection, repulsion of
Syrians.
Being captured by the siege.
Yeah. All right. And when we talk about the king of the Syrians, who was that? Created all this mess that we talked about in the book of Daniel. Antiochus, that's right, Antiochus Epiphanes. And his desire was to take Jerusalem, which he did, and he offered swine upon the altar and polluted the altar, polluted the temple, and that was the beginning of the Maccabean revolt to drive the Syrians out and make sure that that was no more. Now, what Antiochus Epiphanes did is he pressured the people to worship Zeus. Now, I don't know, most of you perhaps are familiar at least with Greek mythology. Who was Zeus? King of the gods. That's right, king of the gods. Now, next question. What did the Greeks call Judah and Edom? They called Judah, Judea, and Edom, Idumea. That's right. Very good. The next one. Who was the first Jew to publicly protest the Syrian order to worship Zeus? As far as our records are concerned. All right. Mattathias Hasmonean, and he was the father, as it were, of the Maccabeans who led in this revolt. Next question, summarize the kind of battles the Maccabees fought against the Syrians. There's one word that does it, but I want somebody to explain it to me.
They had
Okay.
And they rebelled. And they fought someone else, too, with their 800 men. They called them, but at the same time, they were getting weaker.
All right, that's true.
And somebody was waiting to come in and take them after both sides were weakened.
Well, that's true. The Romans were sitting over there waiting. But what kind of battles did the Maccabees engage?
Usually they engage in hit-and-run type battles.
All right.
Guerrilla warfare.
Hit-and-run. Guerrilla warfare. That's the word that our textbook uses. And hit-and-run is good because these folks were day laborers during the day. And then often at night they would run raids on the enemy. And then the idea was no one knew who did that. And so these were the kind of battles in which they engaged. The next one, why was the Septuagint valuable? Now, this gets back to where I kind of wanted to go last time when we were talking about language. Why was the Septuagint so valuable? Pardon me? All right, that's right. You remember the chart that we had a few moments ago where we talked about the Old Testament being written in Hebrew, and how that then toward the end the Aramaic language became popular, and then the Greek language by Alexander the Great was imposed and became the common language of the known world. The Septuagint translation then was what? It was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, why was that so valuable? It indicated two things. It indicated, go ahead, Randy.
Just that anyone in the educated world could read it.
Anyone in the educated world could read it. Excellent. But what we also see is a compiling of the books recognized as authentic text from God. Now, one of the things that we do want to make mention of here is the Septuagint also contained the books that we read in the Douay version that were believed to be history, not necessarily inspired, but they were in the Septuagint. But what it did do is it made it possible for Greeks to read the Bible in their own language. Now, we are going to, perhaps down the pike somewhere, when we're studying church history, we'll talk somewhat about the beginning of translations from Latin into German and a host of other languages, and how that created some pluses, but it also created some negatives. When the Bible was translated into Latin, who had the opportunity to read it? Was Latin the common language of everybody? Alright? It was the common language sometimes of the Romans, and in particular the Catholic Church. And often even today, we hear it read in the Catholic Church and in Latin. But when it began to be translated into Greek and other languages, what then did that enable the people to do? Read it for themselves. And it's interesting to note that during that particular period of time, there was an effort during the period that's identified as the Dark Ages to eliminate all of these other translations so that you could just only have Latin. And what did that do to the populace if you only had Latin? What if you couldn't read Latin?
Made ignorant.
Pardon me?
Made ignorant.
Made them ignorant. That's right. Yes.
Jesus accused the Pharisees of taking away the key of knowledge. And that's exactly that.
All right. Exactly. If you can't read it, you don't know what it says. You're dependent upon somebody else to tell you what it says. Now, moving on with our questions, what were some of the major lessons the Israelites learned from their captivity? One in particular, Joey, what did they learn in captivity?
Well, there are lots of lessons there. I'm not sure which one you're alluding to, but one lesson for sure is that if you turn your back on God and abandon His law, life gets really bad.
It does. Now, that's been the principle that we've noted time and time and time and time and time again. And I want to underscore that in our thinking. Sometimes we think that, well, we just don't talk about the good things that God gives us now and the promises that we enjoy now. But in our studies all through this period, we have noted that Moses in the long ago promised them by the will of God that if they did what God said, what would God do for them? He would bless them. Now, is that always talking about making somebody rich, making you wealthy with gold and silver? No, no. But you'll receive the blessings of God. Now, if you don't do what God said, what became the thing? He'll curse you. All right. Does that mean you're going to die tomorrow? Not necessarily. But it does mean your life will not be blessed. And that's very unfortunate. We're studying about the history and geography of the Bible, and we're summarizing lessons that we've already studied with these questions that we have on the board. But Joey, to answer the question specifically, what I was looking for was they never again worshipped idols. They never again worshipped idols. They had to obey God if they wanted His blessings, recognize who He is, and submit to His will. The next question, which prophet foretold that Christ would be born in Bethlehem? Bruce? No? Wasn't Isaiah? No, wasn't Malachi? Micah. Whoever said Malachi, you were close. It was Micah. Can somebody tell me the chapter and verse? 5:2. Very good. And in Micah's prophecy of Jesus being born in the city of Bethlehem, just how specific was he?
Which Bethlehem?
Which Bethlehem? Now that's fascinating. How many of you were aware, before we talked about it, that there are actually two Bethlehems identified in Scripture? Okay, 1, 2, 3. All right. There's one in Zebulun from Judges chapter 19. And then, of course, here, Micah chapter 5, verse 2, Bethlehem in Judea, or Bethlehem Ephrathah, as it's referred to there. Now, when we look at these kingdoms, the order of the empires, let's put them in order. Rome, Persia, Babylon, Greece, Assyria. Out of this list, what came first? Assyria, that's right. What came second? Babylon. Third? Persia. Next? Greece. And next was Rome. All right, when we read in the prophecy of Daniel, Daniel is interpreting a particular dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had. What's the passage where we read of this? Daniel chapter 2, that's right. What was Nebuchadnezzar's dream? What was his dream? Who do I want to pick on? Linda. What was his dream?
There was this huge statue, and there various parts of it were in different metals metals. The head was of gold, and the breast and the arms were of silver, and the belly and the thighs were of brass, and the legs and the feet were iron, and the bottom and the feet were mixed with clay.
Very good. This is the image that he saw. Now, if I just pushed that button, we'd have that. But now he saw that until a stone rolled down from the mountain and struck the image. Struck the image where?
Feet.
What did it do to the whole thing?
It crumbled.
Now, what did that mean? When Daniel is talking to King Nebuchadnezzar, he explains the interpretation of it. And where do I read this? Daniel chapter 2. Very important prophecy. Jenny, what was the interpretation of this dream? Exactly right. So kingdoms would replace one another until we get to that fourth world empire. And which one was that? Rome. All right. Name the empires from the time of Nebuchadnezzar's dream until the birth of Christ. Let's start out. You said Babylon, and the next one was? the Persian, and the next one was the Greek, and the next one was, all right, Rome. Very good. The next question, which one of the five empires was left out? Now, we've talked about five. Assyria. That's right. Why? It happened before King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Now, that's simple enough. The next question, put these in the correct order. Now, if you're working on a timeline, that's so important to know what came first. So, out of the list here, you've already filled these out in your lesson book. What came first? All right, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of this great image. How did it then begin to develop? What came second? Pardon me? Alexander the Great conquered all the way over to the Indus River or to the Kingdom of India. And then what came next? All right, the Maccabean Revolt came next because we had the Syrians trying to take over Jerusalem and had defiled the temple and so forth. What came next? All right, Rome conquered all the eastern Mediterranean shore. And David used a rather interesting term in previous studies to tell us why. Why did Rome and all these other nations want to control the eastern Mediterranean shore, which was Palestine? Why did they want to control that? It was a choke point. That's right. If you control that little area, you control the trade routes, you control the seaports on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. And then, of course, what came next? Herod the Great became king of Judea. And then, of course, next, Caesar Augustus ordered the subjects to be taxed, and that caused Joseph to go where? To Bethlehem, where Joseph and Mary had a little boy. And that fulfills these. Thank you very much for doing all of that and putting that in order for us. Now, in our study, we want to continue into lesson number 42. Lesson number 42. I hope that you'll find this to be quite fascinating. I've asked some of you to look up every passage that uses Herod's name and tell me in that passage which Herod is being spoken of. Now, we'll see the significance of that as our study progresses. But we know that there were a number of Herods during this time frame. The name of several Roman rulers in Palestine region during Jesus' earthly ministry and the period shortly before his birth and after his resurrection. Here are the main characters: Herod the Great, Herod Archelaus, Herod Antipas, Herod Agrippa the First, and Herod Agrippa the Second. Now, just the listing of those names, I would like to, by the time we're finished with this, have you plug in certain passages so that when one is mentioned, you'll know at least one or two passages that talk about that particular Herod. Because these are essential, very crucial characters in our study. You remember in our study of Old Testament kings, this chart? And some looked at this chart and said, oh, I won't ever get that. Where we talked about the lineage of kings from David to Jehoshaphat to Jehoram to Ahaziah to Joash. And then we looked in Israel during this time period from Omri to Ahab, who had a son named Jehoram, same as Jehoshaphat had a son named Jehoram. And he also had a son named Ahaziah, also the son of Jehoram over on this side. And we look at that and we say, well, Athaliah married Jehoram and they had a son and they named him after Athaliah's brother. And we look at all that, we got these names just flying everywhere, and we say, I don't think I'll ever be able to learn that. And then, to make bad matters worse, we have Ahaziah, who is also discussed in these passages under the name of Jehoahaz. And when we talk about Joash, we studied him under the same characterization, but the name is Jehoash. And we talked about all of that. You remember the confusion that that kind of created? And if it didn't create confusion then, you just look at that. Doesn't that create confusion for you? It's not my desire this morning just to create confusion, but to help us to see that sometimes there's a great deal of study involved in trying to identify characters in the Bible. But once we've identified the characters in the Bible, it makes the storyline just become alive because we know who these people are. And we know what connection they had with other prominent characters in the Scriptures. And so this particular chart is in your lesson book. Now you say, I can't even see that, Nick. Well, I know that. So I'm going to try to fix that by looking at this. Now, one of the things that you'll note is, I can make that bigger. But now you can see where it begins. Look at your lesson book. Do you see the Herodian family tree? Antipater II, the Idumean, poisoned about 43 B.C., and his son was identified as Herod the Great. Now, I've got another chart that is perhaps a little bit more readable, but I'm going to work from this one because it's in our lesson book. But this particular chart, and you're welcome to have a copy of it if you would like, is a little bit better where you see the Herodian family. You don't see Antipater up here, but you see it begin with Herod the Great. Now, Herod the Great had about 10 wives. Now, two of them, at least, he ordered to be killed. And he had, by these women, a number of sons. These two sons, he had them killed. Now, Herod the Great was not a very nice fellow, just to put it simple. But he was very suspicious of anybody that raised what might even be a hint of treason against him. And so if you were not supporting Herod the Great completely and fully, then you'd just be executed. Now that's how he dealt with you. Which in and of itself tells us a great deal about who he is. But Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great. Now, Herod the Great, as I mentioned, had a multiplicity of wives, about 10 of them. But on this chart, we have it kind of boiled down to three main wives. And in this list, we find that through this woman, he had Herod Philip, who married Herodias. Herod Philip, who married Herodias, was eventually disinherited. We've got Herod Antipas over here, who later visited over here Herod Philip and took Herodias after they were divorced, and she became his wife. And it's during this time that we read of the message of John the Baptist, who rebuked Herod Antipas because he had taken his brother's wife, and he said, that's not lawful for you to do that. Now, one of the significant things here that I want to inject into our study is it's not lawful by whose law?
God's law.
God's law. Yes, God's law. Now, I'm glad that you said it that way because Herod was not under the rule of the law of Moses, but he was under God's law. Why was he not under the rule of the law of Moses? He wasn't a Jew. What was his background? He was an Edomite. Idumea, yes, he was an Edomite. Now the Herods had, on the surface, adopted the Jews' religion. But they were evil from the get-go, just bad folks. So they did not submit to the law of Moses. When John rebukes Herod Antipas for taking your brother Philip's wife, he's not rebuking him for breaking the law of Moses. He's rebuking him from breaking God's law. Now, why is that such a significant point in some modern day discussions among brethren? Joey?
What it demonstrates is that whether you know it or not, or like it or not, everybody's under God's law. And that's very easy to demonstrate, because the scripture says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So if all have sinned, then all are under law. Now some, depending on what time in history you're talking about, some people might have been under a different law in another group. But ultimately, everybody is always under God's law.
Exactly right. And when we talk about Herod Antipas, though he was not a Jew, though he was not bound by God's law, or bound by the law of Moses, there are those who say, well, the law of Moses said that it was incest to take your brother's wife. And therefore, what John is rebuking him for was incest. So if you take somebody else's wife, then I suppose that'd be all right. Would it be all right if he took your wife? Why? Contrary to God's law from the beginning. Yes.
Someone, I think the point you're getting at is some would make take the position now that God's laws in the New Testament concerning marriage, divorce, and remarriage don't apply if you're not a Christian.
That's right. That's right.
And some people would make the argument that if you've got, if you went through, you know, five or six wives before you became a Christian, and as soon as you're baptized, you stick with the one you got, you're fine.
That's right. Repent and be baptized and wash away thy wives. No, that's not what it says. That's just not what it says. Now, this man, he had a position of preeminence. You'll notice that all of these were described as tetrarchs. Now, in my initial study of this, that really threw me for a curve. Because in Luke chapter 3, we read about Philip the tetrarch. And it sounds like that there's only one, doesn't it? The tetrarch. But there is not just one tetrarch. What does that word mean? Pardon me? Four. Yes, it means four. Now, if you'll notice, the kingdom of Herod the Great was divided between Herod Philip, Herod Antipas, Archelaus, and Herod Philip over here. They were all tetrarchs. This one in particular is referred to as an ethnarch, which kind of gives him a rank just a little bit above. And this one was disinherited. So when we read in Josephus about who reigned over what portion of the land, we read of the three. We read of Herod Antipas, who was a tetrarch. We read of Archelaus, who was an ethnarch, basically the same thing, just a little bit of elevation of authority. And Herod Philip, who was the tetrarch. Now, if I could zoom in, Richard, on these, you'll notice the... I'm not sure I know how to do that. Let's see.
Where it says 66.5%.
How about if I go to view and pick up that right there? And then I go like that. Yeah. Now you can see that, can't you? Okay. Oh, yes. Yes. So when we talk about these, there are passages that we're going to be discussing, and we want to discuss these individually as we go along through our lesson even this morning. But I want you to see on this chart, if I can operate this, you look up there. You'll notice that Herod Antipas, as it states here, the daughter of Artus, tetrarch of Galilee and Perea. Do you see that? And then when we come over here, we've got Archelaus, who was the ethnarch of Judea and Samaria and Idumea. And then as we come over here, we've got Philip, who was the tetrarch of... Pronounce that for me, Richard, please. All right, and then Trachonicus and Gareolicus, if I'm close, and some of these other places, as we see identified in Luke chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. Now, the significance of that is to help us to see that when we're looking at the land of Palestine, and we read about these different Herods, we're talking about who was Herod of what portion of Palestine. And when we read that Jesus moved around and John somewhat moved around, and it identifies the relationship of this person to Herod, we want to know which Herod. Now that becomes kind of a fascinating, Carolyn, and somewhat of an intense study to notice that. One other thing I want to notice on this before we go on to another chart is you see that Herod Philip is on this chart identified as marrying Salome. Now let's turn our map back just a little bit and see who he married. Who did he marry? Herod Philip married Salome. Who was she? Daughter of Herodias. That's right. So who did he marry? His niece. Yeah, he married his niece. Now, in picking that up, let's go back to some other things that I want to talk with you about just a little further down the pike. Notice as the lineage of Herod's continue, we're then introduced to Herod Agrippa the First, and you'll notice that it follows down through this wife. Herod Agrippa the First. Let me move this over. And we're going to read about them specifically in the book of Acts. Herod Agrippa the First and Herod Agrippa the Second. Herod Agrippa the First ultimately became a king over all of Palestine. And you'll read about him specifically in Acts chapter 12. Yes, Jenny?
As a point of interest, it looked like the wife he came down through was of the lineage of the Maccabees.
That's probably right. Now, I hadn't thought of that, but that's probably right.
Yeah. Some sort of daughter of John Hyrcanus.
Yeah, interesting observation. I hadn't noticed that. But when we look about Herod Agrippa the First, we read about him in Acts chapter 12. And in Acts chapter 12, we've really come down the pike from Acts chapter 2, where we read about the beginning of the Lord's church. When we come to Acts chapter 12, we find that this is the first of the enlistment of Roman authorities to persecute the church. When we read about the church being persecuted in Acts chapter 3, 4, 5, who was responsible for it? Who? Not yet. Acts 3, 4, 5, on up through chapter 9.
Jews.
That's right. Jews were responsible for it. When we read of the conversion of Saul, then we read of a subsiding of the persecution for a while from the hand of the Jews. Acts 10, Acts chapter 11, kind of a parenthesis, because we see in that the conversion of the Gentiles, and then Agabus came down to Antioch and so forth and prophesied concerning the famine. But when we come into Acts chapter 12, the church now has a new enemy. And it's not just the Jews, but the Jews have implemented the authority of Herod to persecute those who are Christians. And what does he first do? He arrests James and Peter. And what does he do just to please the Jews? Because he's the king. He kills James, cut his head off. And what was his obvious intent to do to Peter? Same thing. But how did Peter avoid that consequence? He was delivered miraculously by an angel. All right, and we'll talk about that more. I just want you to see it while we're on this particular chart. When we drop down just a little further and read about Herod Agrippa the Second, he's tetrarch of the Chalcis and Northern Territory, and we know that it is this Herod before whom Paul made his defense. In Acts chapter 24, 25, and 26. But let me back up just a little bit further. I'd like for you to remember these chapters. When you go back to Acts chapter 21, there's a sequence, almost a different event in every chapter. In Acts chapter 21, when Paul came into the city of Jerusalem to bring alms to the church, or to bring benevolence to those in the church in Jerusalem, what happened to him? He was arrested. That's right. When we come to Acts chapter 22, what did Paul do? Not yet. He's going up the steps. Makes his defense before this mob of Jewish people. That's right. And then, Jenny, in Acts chapter 23, who's he before? The Sanhedrin court. That's right. And then, in Acts chapter 24, who does he stand before? Felix. Yes, very good. A Roman governor. And then, Felix ends his period of governorship, and who's the next governor? Festus. And that begins Acts chapter 25, where Paul makes his defense before Festus. And in making his defense before Festus, Paul's had enough of this being shifted from pillar to post. And so what does he do? I appeal to Caesar. That's right. And it's about that time that Herod Agrippa II comes down to Jerusalem, where Paul is. And Herod Agrippa II says that if Paul had not appealed to Caesar, then I don't see anything worthy of death in him. But because he's appealed to Caesar he shall go. Now, when we look at that, and see who this Agrippa was. And in Paul's defense before Agrippa II in Acts chapter 26, it's that context where Paul asked Agrippa, "Believest thou the prophets? I know thou believest." And Agrippa said, "With but little persuasion," or in the King James translation, "almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." Now, there's some controversy on that, whether Agrippa is saying, "Paul, you've almost got me," or whether he's kind of mocking Paul by saying, "You think that with just a little bit of persuasion you can make me to be a Christian?" We'll talk more about that when we get to Acts 26. But this is the lineage of the Herods that we're going to be discussing in the Herod family tree. Now, as this chart is a little bit plainer, we may come back to that and use it time and time again. But this chart is the one that's in your book. And it's very helpful. I forget the page that it's on.
168.
168, thank you. Page 168. I got 5 minutes. Is that the first or second? Oh. All right. Always a smart aleck, never cried, I tell you. Well, when we talk about Herod Antipas, the beginning of all of this, he was a very wise administrator. We know that the temple had been destroyed during the days of Nebuchadnezzar. We know that the Jews, when they returned, they rebuilt the temple. But the Jews who were present during the rebuilding of the temple, many of them who had seen it in its former glory, what did they do? They wept. Because they couldn't imagine anything that would exceed the glory of the temple that Solomon built. But during the days of Herod Antipas, he added on, I have on the board he rebuilt, he added on to the temple, making it larger. And he also granted Jews a number of privileges. We'll talk more about those when we get specifically to our lesson. And then when we read about Herod the Great, his son, king of Judea, we noted that he ordered that two of his sons be killed because there was some belief that they were leading in some kind of treacherous thing. And so he ordered that his own sons be killed. And then when we read about Archelaus, we note that he was given Judea and Samaria, as we saw on the other chart, and he was the one that was reigning when Joseph brought his family from Egypt to Nazareth. We'll talk more about that when we get a little further along in our study. And Herod Antipas, notice the arrow, that it was Herod Antipas that took his brother Philip's wife. He's the one that ordered that John be beheaded. And then Herod the Tetrarch, of course, keeping in mind that all of these are called Tetrarchs, But this particular Herod is the one that's identified in Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, who married the daughter of Herodias and was given the portion just northeast of Galilee. Now, I want to ask you, if I use this chart, is it advantageous to anybody? Not a soul, huh? Well, it's in the book, yes. Okay, well, keep in mind that it's in the book. Quit that, pushing the wrong button. Okay, well, let's go back now to our charts. Herod family, pardon me? He doesn't. Well, yeah. Well, this particular chart I have circled the folks who were identified as Herod in the scriptures. Now, when you're just reading along and you read Herod, it could be this fellow, it could be this one, this one, this one, this one, this one, or this one. So you see now the confusion. You need to read the context. Isn't that a marvel thought? Read the context and know which one that you're studying about. And it'll also help you to know the character of that fellow and with whom he came in contact. Whether we're talking about Paul, or whether we're talking about John, or whether we're talking about Jesus. And so all of these characters are important. Now, let's back up just a little bit. Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2. In Matthew chapter 2, I've got 30 seconds to read that whole chapter and discuss it. How about if I just read verse 1? It says, "Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men came from the east to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and are come to worship him.'" What Herod are we talking about? Herod the Great. That's right. Now, when they came to ask Herod the Great, "Where is Jesus that we heard or that was to be born? We come to worship him." What was Herod's reaction? Troubled. Why?
Because this is
another king.
Another king.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, he went on and said, "Oh, let me know when you find him. I want to worship him."
Yeah. So when I find him, I can kill him.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Well, we'll start there next time. Thank you so much for your participation.